hello everyone. Hello to everyone listening. This is to this recording. My name is Nadine Honeybone, the founder of the Autism Directory. I'm here on this call today with a very inspirational woman and a well-known in the autism community, Anna Kennedy. Hello, Anna.
Hello there, Nadine. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Now, before I ask Anna to get started on her story and share some insights with you, I'd just like to give you a little bit of background about Anna. And just to say how inspirational Anna has been to myself in giving me the confidence to launch the Autism Directory. Anna is the mother of two boys, Patrick and Angelo, who I'm sure we'll hear more about in a minute, both on the autism spectrum, who found herself, like many other parents, not able to get the support and knowing that she had to do something for her son's education and others like them. So Anna, please could you just start by telling us a little bit about your early days when autism came into your life and the story around the diagnosis?
Okay, yes. I've got two sons. Patrick's now 21 and he has a diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome. And Angelo is now 18 and he has a diagnosis of autism and epilepsy. And he also suffers from eczema now and again when the particular weather gets quite bad. I set myself milestones within my life. I said I wanted to be married before I was 30 and I wanted to have my first child before I was 30. And I actually had Patrick when I was 29 and 10 months. So I just made it in time. Patrick was born in January 1990, but he was a premature baby because I had preeclampsia and toxemia. And I had quite an awful pregnancy and he was born in 29 weeks. So he's quite small, and obviously that was quite frightening for me. And I didn't see him for the first 3 days because I was quite ill. I had to have 24-hour care, and I had to have a nurse by my bed for the 3 days after I had him. But then they wheeled him into the SCBU, and I saw him in there, and it obviously was quite frightening to see a baby with lots of wires, you know, and he was just so small, and he looked like a little chicken, really. And his feet were so small that they had little socks that they sellotape round. So it was. I was frightened to touch him because I thought I might hurt him. But then obviously I became, familiar with the procedure and what you had to do and what I was able to do and all the rest of it. So Patrick was in there for about 10, 11 weeks and I only brought him home for about 10 days and then he was quite ill and I had to rush him to hospital. And he'd stopped breathing and he had septicemia. They thought that he had meningitis, but he had this septicemia and he just seemed to be picking up one thing after another for the first 3 years of his life. So he became quite a clingy child and I thought it was because as well, you know, because of the difficulties that he had. So I took him to nursery and he found it extremely difficult at nursery. They said that when they used to play things like Farmer in the Dell or things that were like group activities, and Patrick just would not join in. He'd basically just walk around the edge of the hall or the place where he was at. He'd stick to one particular lady whose name was Maria, who I met a few years down the line, and he just found it really difficult to settle. And then when we took him to mainstream school, he found it extremely difficult to settle, and he became very anxious, started having nightmares, drew angry pictures, started building detonator boxes out of cornflake boxes to say he was going to blow up St. Mary's School. Didn't really have any friends. Again, he'd walk around the playground. He'd make his lunch last the whole hour so he didn't have to go out at lunchtime. And just was not a happy boy, really. Started getting quite angry and didn't like it when people used to come into our house, used to run up into his bedroom and shut the door and said he didn't need human beings, that they were rubbish. So it was quite worrying, really, to see Patrick sort of develop into this very sort of angry and, had high anxiety levels. And in the meantime, I had Angelo after 3 years. It was in 1993. And they said it would be rare to get preeclampsia and toxemia again, but I got it. And I was in hospital for 11 weeks, and it was the most boring 11 weeks I'd ever been, sort of sitting in bed, and I wasn't allowed to get out of bed. And anyway, I managed to get to full term with Angelo, and again I had to have a cesarean section, and Angelo was quite a sort of a placid, happy child, and in a way I was quite pleased because of the difficulties that I was having with Patrick. But then it sort of when Angelo started getting to about 2 years old, he started acting a little bit strange and being fixated with patterns on the wallpaper, lining things up across the floor in the lounge. It could be anything from a cup, a book, a ruler, an ornament, and it'd be perfect straight line. And I'm sure that if I had a tape measure and measured them, that they would be exactly the same width apart from each other. And if you happen to move that line, he would scream and kick and shout. And then I realized that that wasn't good for him because he was becoming quite fixated with it. So in the end, I purposefully started moving things around so that, you know, he wouldn't line up all of these articles across the floor. And because we were going through such difficulties, we were going to see a psychotherapist as a family. And Patrick was having sessions on his own as well. And he was actually, what he used to do was they used to have little figures that he would have his own little box. It would be called the Patrick's box. So every time he went every week, and they'd have these figures. And what he'd do was he'd actually put plasticine across their faces because he didn't want to look at the faces of these particular figures. So I suppose if he thought human beings were rubbish and he was going through all these anxieties, I suppose this meant something in the psychotherapist world, but obviously it wasn't explained to me at the time. So obviously we were going through quite a stressful time as a family, and we were having real difficulties in getting Patrick to school. He would kick and scream, and every time I used to try and get him out of the car, he'd wrap his legs around the buggy so I wouldn't take him. And it was really a struggle because I was on my own, because we lived in London and all my family and all Sean's family lived in Middlesbrough, because we're from the northeast. You probably picked it up from my accent. So I didn't have anyone really to support me up here at all. So I just found it really difficult. And then I couldn't get him in the classroom. We'd spend hours in the reception area, and the teachers used to try and get him into the classroom, but he wasn't having any of it. So for 3 years this went on, and I had car accidents as well, where he tried to get hold of the steering wheel to stop me from driving him there, and he'd say, please don't take me to that place, I hate it, there's eyes looking at me, there's mouth that swallows me up when I get there. Obviously he was soiling and wetting himself at night time, and just really, really anxious young man. And it's, I know this might be a horrible thing to say, but at the time I just thought, oh, I don't know if I'm going to be able to cope with all this, because it was just so stressful and I was just absolutely shattered. So anyway, one particular day Patrick sobbed and sobbed, and I managed to get him out of the car, and there's a brick wall that's opposite the gate of St Mary's School, and he buried his head in the wall and he just started crying. And basically I just couldn't get him away from the wall, and this I used to hate the looks of the parents that I used to get when I used to have to try and drag Patrick and Angelo into school. And one particular parent saw this happening and ran to get Mrs Doherty, who was the head teacher at the time, and she came and just said, what are we doing to this young man? So she called a review, and we basically all went to this review. There was myself, my husband, the ed psych, the one-to-one lady that was working with Patrick, and various other professionals in the room. And the psychotherapist, she wanted to attend, but she couldn't attend at the time. So what she did was she put a report together and handed it out to, well, sent it to be handed out to everybody. And the first sentence in the report said Patrick was diagnosed in 1994 with Asperger syndrome, and this was 1997. And they just said, oh, why didn't you tell us, Mrs. Kennedy? And I just said, I've just found out now, same time as you have. And I couldn't concentrate on the rest of the meeting. I was just stressed to the hilt because Angelo had just previously been diagnosed with autism. And then I was thinking, what have I done wrong? Is there something that I could have done differently? Is it because I had preeclampsia and toxemia? Is that why both boys have got autism and Asperger's syndrome? And you're looking for somebody to blame, but there's nobody to blame. You've still got the same boys that you had, but they basically just got a label of autism and Asperger's syndrome. So after the meeting, I remember sort of going home, and I just rang my mum, and I couldn't speak, and I just cried probably for about 10, 15 minutes, really. And then I just sort of put the phone down, and then my mum rang back asking what was going on, and then I explained to her about Patrick being diagnosed, and obviously she was angry because they hadn't told us. So anyway, that was how I was thrown into the world of autism, really. And then obviously we had to go through this process of getting a statement of special educational needs and going through the statutory procedure and speaking to the statementing officer that we had at the time. And she said that she basically didn't know anything about autism, and the ball was in my court, and that both my boys were unique, and it was up to me to try and find the right type of provision for Patrick and Angelo, which made me feel even more isolated. I remember I started reading books, and the first book I read was a book called Autism and the Facts. And then I read a Tony Atwood book on Asperger's syndrome, and I was then just really hungry for information, because nobody basically sat down with me and said, this is what autism is. And then I discovered all these various different strategies like PECS and TEACH and LOVAS. And I thought, well, what are all these? You know, is somebody going to sit down and explain them to me? And obviously these were key things that I'm thinking, you know, which one do I choose for Patrick? Which one do I choose for Angelo? How, you know, because obviously, you know, it was very important, because this was obviously going to have an impact on the rest of their lives. And I just felt really, really frustrated. And basically no one sat down with me. And I remember ringing the National Autistic Society, and obviously this was in 1997, and there wasn't as that much information as there is today on their website, and there wasn't really that much on there. So I actually rang them, and I couldn't get through for the sort of the first, I don't know how many times I tried, and I left a few messages. Anyway, eventually I got a call back, and I said, you know, I've just got some with autism and Asperger's syndrome, both sons, and is there anything that you can recommend, really? Anything visual that I can see, or anything on strategies or anything? So I remember they recommended this video, and I can't remember what it was called now. I remember it was green and white. Obviously, those were the colours then, I think, of the National Autistic Society. And it was a video of children that were really quite severe with autism, and no disrespect to those children, but it's just not what I wanted to see when I was. It was just so raw with me, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And I watched the first sort of 5 minutes, and then what I did was I basically just got the video and I put it in the boot of the car. I just didn't even want it in the house, and I was just thinking, is that what I've got to look forward to, you know, for Patrick and Angelo? Anyway, after the statement in officer basically told it was down to me, so I started doing some research, trying to find out about schools that could cater for children with autism. And there was some schools that had units attached. There were some schools that were for children that were very severe with autism. So what I decided to do was visit lots of different schools to get an idea of what exactly was out there, and, you know, what the chances were of Patrick and Angelo getting a school, to be able to go to school. So both my husband and I didn't come to all of the schools with me, because obviously he was working for Thames Water at the time. And I went to visit all these schools, and there was a lot of schools that were really quite institutionalised looking and clinical looking, which is not really what I wanted for Patrick and Angelo. Then there was a couple of schools that we quite liked, but they said because we didn't live in the area, there was not even, wasn't even worth us putting our name down on the list, because there was just so many children that were waiting for a place. So I spoke to the local authority. They said all they could offer me was 5 hours home tuition for Patrick and Angelo. And so this is what they had every week. And Patrick had a lady called Vanessa who was very good, but 5 hours obviously wasn't enough. And in the end, I actually ended up employing Vanessa, and she worked at Hillingdon Manor School. But the other lady, she'd never worked with a child with autism. And because Angelo's autism was so complex, because he had hardly any speech at all, very much in his locked in his own world, after the third day, she just sat on the lounge carpet in our lounge, really, and she started crying. She said she was really sorry. She didn't know what to do. She'd never worked with a child like Angelo before, which obviously, you know, I felt sorry for her, but it didn't inspire confidence. And then because of all these books that I was reading about early intervention and how crucial it was, it just made me even more frustrated. So anyway, I met up with another parent who had a child with semantic pragmatic language disorder, and I remember seeing her child kicking off. And I went up to her and asked her if I could help. And I said, and she just told me that a child had just been diagnosed. And I said, I thought I recognised the type of tantrum that he was having, because obviously experiencing it with Patrick and sometimes with Angelo. And she said she felt quite isolated. So I said, there must be other parents that have got children with autism. So anyway, in the end, we got together and we started finding out about other parents. And we set up a support group, first of all, within my lounge at home with just a few parents. And then we started finding out about more and more parents. So we went to the local church and asked if we could use their hall, and they let us have it for free, which was great. So we used to meet once every month, and all these parents started coming out the woodwork. And in the end, there was about 275 families of children that were affected by autism or Asperger's syndrome, or they were adults and they were in a mental health unit, which was so obviously quite scary as well. And we were thinking, is that what the outcome is for a child, you know, that's going to be diagnosed? They're going to end up in a mental health unit if there's nothing for them. So anyway, the support group started growing, and we were getting more frustrated being at home. I had to basically give up my job and look after Patrick and Angelo at home. We turned our garage into a classroom, and I then started going to work in the evening because we were struggling money-wise. So I went to a doctor's answering service. I was working for Health Call, and I was doing 6 till 11 and just basically taking calls for emergencies or directing the doctors out to visits or filling out the drug boxes, things like that. That was quite interesting. And it just wasn't a way to live, really, because Angelo was a very, very poor sleeper and still is. You've probably seen on Facebook that I talk about how he doesn't seem to need a lot of sleep. So I just felt like the whole family was on automatic pilot. You know, we were going through this process of the tutors coming in during the day, me trying to take the kids to the park or trying to keep them occupied all the time. And then Sean coming in from work, making his tea, then I'd go out. And then I'd come back here at 11, at 12 o'clock at night. Angelo would be asleep for a few hours. Then I'd have to get up again. And it was like that for sort of 3 years. And I just thought, this is not a way to live here. And it was sort of getting quite tense as well between Sean and I, because obviously, you know, we were tired, knackered, I think the word is. So so we started chatting in the support group, and a gentleman said that he'd heard about a school that was quite near to where I lived, so I rang the local authority and asked about it, and I found out it was a school called the Moorcroft School, and it was for kids that had physical disabilities. So I went to have a look at it, and actually it was really near to where I live, but because there was loads of bushes and trees in front of the site, you wouldn't actually know that there was a driveway there, because it was all overgrown, because it had been empty for about 18 months to 2 years. So what I did was I climbed over the fence and looked in the windows and saw these empty rooms, and sort of the toilets were smashed, and there was like sinks that were smashed, and it obviously needed new windows because there was trees growing through the windows, and it needed a new roof. And so I told my husband about it, and this other gentleman, so we obviously went to have a look at it, and then we just decided maybe we need to do something with this, because this is no way to live. So I approached the local authority and I spoke to a lady. I always remember her name's Mary Milne. She was head of client services, and she was actually looking after the statements as well, and I'd dealt with her a few times through Patrick and Angelo. And I said about this school, and she said she would see what she could do, and she spoke to people. And anyway, they put us through the mill, and we had to do a feasibility study to see if there was a need for a school like this. And we had to put together a business plan, and luckily my husband Sean had done a degree in economics and management, and so he was really handy for doing the business plan, because it's something that I'd never ever even done before. So anyway, to cut a long story short, we battled with the local authority, and they just put us through the mill really, and lots of red tape, and we finally got them to agree, and it went to council chambers at Hillingdon, and it was a unanimous decision that they would lease the building to us for 30 years as long as we could put our names to £627,000 worth of refurbishment, and we only had £3,000 in the bank. We just said, yes, we can do it.
Yes, we can do it.
Because I was desperate. So what I started doing really was I started going to the local newspaper. I started going to big organisations. I got a few tips from the lady from the newspaper, who's still a friend now. She said, try and, when you write to people, write it on coloured paper, because they get so many demands from people, requests, yeah, I should say, from people, and it's all on white paper. So if it's on coloured paper, it'll stand out, you know, from the pile, if you like. And don't sort of write things like War and Peace. Make sure it's short and sharp and to the point, bullet points. So that's what I started doing, and I put an article in the paper and went to the probation service and asked if they'd support us as well. And they used to come every weekend and do painting and cleaning and gardening, and the Princess Trust got on board as well. Then parents started coming to help, who were carpenters and Corgi gas registered people, or doing painting and decorating, or even just like cleaning, because it was obviously, you can imagine how dirty the whole place was. And it just all started coming together. So obviously we had to advertise for a head teacher. Never done that before. So I started looking in the Times Educational Supplement. I spoke to the National Autistic Society, and I spoke to a lady called Rosemary Siddles, and asked her how was the best way to put an advert, you know, what's the key words to put in an advert for a head teacher. So she gave me a few tips, and that's what we did. And we actually got quite a few responses, but some of them were from people that were quite, there was one lady, let's say, she was 88 and she applied for the job. So that's obviously not what we were looking for. So in the end, we managed to finally find somebody who had lots of experience in autism and also had experience as a speech and language therapist. And she said she would take the job as long as she could bring someone along with her who she was working with. And she said that at the time she was actually told by lots of people not to touch the job with a barge pole, because what did we know? We were only parents. Yeah. But she said she was up for a challenge, and she could see how determined and enthusiastic that I was and how passionate I was about what I wanted to do. And so in the end, she came on board, and we opened the school on September 1999, and 19 children came through the door, and there was lots of parents crying when the kids were coming through the door. And Patrick and Angelo, I was just like quite an experience, really, and like an adrenaline rush and sort of fear and happiness at the same time, hoping it was all going to work, because obviously it was something that we'd never done before. Yeah. And Ofsted came a month after we opened the school, because that's what they did at the time. They don't do that now, but at that time they come a month after. And I remember being sick the night before the Ofsted inspector came, and I had a migraine. And just, obviously, if he said it wasn't working, then, you know, all that work that we'd done would be sort of out the window. But I remember his name was David. I can't remember his second name now. But he came and basically said at the end of the day, if he had a child with autism, he wouldn't hesitate and send them to the school. And after he went, we were all running up and down the corridor shouting. And we had a little party afterwards, and it was just like really quite, you know, we were just like overjoyed with that it had worked. And since then, Hillingdon Manor School has grown from strength to strength, and we're on three different sites now.
Right.
And we've just opened a new primary school because of the demand. And all the children have access to the national curriculum, and it's age for pupils between 3.5 to 11, obviously, the primary school, and then 11 right up to 19 for the secondary school. And we split the secondary school site from sort of 11 to 16, and then we've got 16 to 19, so equivalent to like a sixth form college, if you like. Right. And we've got children that who are doing GCSEs, who are able, and we've got quite a few GCSEs that the children have passed, which is great, because a lot of these kids were kids that had been excluded from mainstream. And we've expanded the curriculum now so that the children that are not so academically, you know, inclined, like Angelo, because obviously his needs are quite complex, that they can do other things like painting, decorating, horticulture, plumbing, beauty. We've got food technology, and we just photography. We're just expanding the curriculum all the time for the interest that the children have, and we don't just follow one particular strategy. You know, we use the best. We have an eclectic approach, so we use the best, like things like we use picture exchange communication, teach. Some of the children we might have to use Makaton, because all the children are so different from each other. So one strategy obviously doesn't cater for every particular child. So what we do is we get to know the child really well in the first sort of three, sometimes it might take 6 months, and we see where their strengths and weaknesses are. And then obviously we work on the strengths, because quite a few of the children that have come to us to secondary obviously got quite low self-esteem because they've been bullied in mainstream school. So, and also they need to trust us because they've been let down so many times in the past. So that's Hillingdon Manor School, really.
Oh, brilliant. So you said it's on three sites. Is that the Baston House as well? Is that part of Hillingdon?
No, Baston House School is another. This is the second school now. This sister school of Hillingdon Manor School. Because my dream is to have lots of schools around the country.
I was going to ask you about your dreams later.
I'd like to have the template of Hillingdon Manor School. We've set up a college as well, West London Community College for adults. It's a vocational college, and we've now split that into two sites where we have like adults who've got Asperger's and autism, and then another site for adults like Angelo, because I'm thinking Angelo's going to be 19 next year. Where's he going to go? There isn't anything, so that hence set up a college. So now I know that he's got somewhere to go. Obviously, I'm going to have to probably start battling for the funding for him to go to West London Community College. But we've got 45 students in total, and we work around the student all the time. So the programmes are actually set around the student. So we've got one particular gentleman who's doing a degree at Birkbeck University, and my husband did a degree there, and he knew of all the pitfalls, because my husband's got a diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome. He was diagnosed about 8 or 9 years ago, I think it was.
Okay.
And so he knew the pitfalls of how it didn't work for him at Birkbeck.
Yeah.
So what we did was we did a lot of training there and spoke to the university, and now this young man is on his fourth, the final year of his IT degree, so it's working really well for him. What we do is we support him in the college and making sure he's keeping up with his modules and making sure he's keeping on track, because even though he's the most able young man in the college, he's probably the most vulnerable, because he can sort of get easily sidetracked quite easily and quite vulnerable, if you can get my gist.
Yeah.
Then we have young people that don't want to go to mainstream college, but they want to do distance learning. So we have three or four pupils, not pupils, students, I should say, that are doing distance learning. So they'd be doing English or psychology or whatever their interest is. And then we have obviously work experience. So we've got young people there that want to go out to work. And we've got a gentleman who's just got himself a part-time job. So we get, it's difficult to try and find work experience places. It's difficult enough if you haven't got a disability, but when you have got a disability, obviously it's difficult, and usually you get things like, you know, pushing trolleys at Sainsbury's or, but we're looking for things that are more exciting than that. So we've managed to find quite a few companies now that are interested in taking on our pupils from the school and also students from the college. So that's really good, and that's expanding all the time. And I've actually just heard, I actually heard this a couple of weeks ago, that our very first student pupil at Hillingdon Manor School has just managed to secure himself a full-time job at Goldman Sachs, so the bank. So we're really proud of him. And then we've got another young man that I speak to on Facebook who set up his own painting and decorating business, and he's got himself married and he's got a couple of kids. So it's nice to hear from them after all those years, if you like, you know, to see how they're progressing. Obviously, there's going to be pupils like Angelo, who's always going to need one-to-one support. You know, he's not going to be able to live on his own. You know, he's got no sense of danger whatsoever. He's always going to need that one-to-one support. But we have got students who are quite capable of getting themselves a job, getting married, you know, getting themselves a house and all the rest of it. And Patrick has done fantastically well, considering he's a young man. Well, to start off with, he was 2 pounds when he was born, so now he's six foot tall, and he's working at Hillingdon Manor School, so he's sort of come full circle, if you like. So he's working with my brother Tony, and he's into landscape gardening, and he does maintenance work. And Patrick has started working with him. He's been with him now for about 10 months, and he seems to be really quite enjoying the job, and he's also got quite good skills on IT, so he's got that other avenue if he wanted to go down that road as well.
Right. So it sounds all very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned back in when you were talking about the early days, and I mean, Anna, you are a published author too, and I remember reading in your book, Not Stupid, mm-hmm. about some of the challenges in the early days with that lack of support.
Yes.
Do you think things are different now for parents that have a recent diagnosis? Do you think the support is different from when you were trying to get it?
I'm actually quite frustrated, because all those years ago, I think things haven't really moved on as much as I would like them to, because obviously I speak to parents on Facebook, and I get, you know, hundreds of messages in my inbox, and I speak to parents on Twitter. I speak to people on Anna Kennedy Online, which is an information portal that I've set up on autism, and also there's a few other things in there, like a bit on fashion and that. And I just thought I'd throw something in there just to, so it's not such heavy going on autism all the time. But parents are still struggling for a diagnosis. You know, some parents are waiting up to 2 years, 5 years, 7 years. I spoke to a gentleman that was 77 that just had a recent diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome, and he said he was glad that he'd gone through the process, because now he feels like a big weight has been lifted off from his shoulders. There's parents think that once they have got the diagnosis, that it's everything's going to fall in their lap, that they're going to get all this provision, but that's not the case at all. That's just the first hurdle. It seems like you get a diagnosis of autism. I'm not saying this is for everybody. You know, some people are quite lucky and they can get provision quite quickly. But I would say for a very high percentage of parents, it's like a real struggle to get diagnosis, to get a statement of special educational needs, to find the right school that's going to be able to educate and care for their child. Going through the transition process, once they get to 18, 19, that is a different ball game altogether. If their, you know, sons are not able to go to mainstream and they're looking for a specialist college, there are hardly any around there at all. That's why we had to set up West London Community College, and we've set up the Old Vicarage, which is an 8-bedroom home for adults that are going to need constant support, and we're looking at doing supported living now as well. But to be honest with you, everything I've done has been inspired by my sons, because I'm always thinking about when they're at the next stage, and to be honest, primarily it's about them, but then lots of other children and adults have benefited from, you know, obviously me trying to make sure that everything's in place for Patrick, for Angelo, and for other children and adults like them, because obviously all the parents have the worry is what's going to happen to them when you're dead and gone. And I think about that an awful lot. I think Patrick's going to be, you know, okay. I think he's got a lot of skills and strategies now that are going to help him. He's obviously going to need support now and again, and that's why I've set up various organisations so that if he does need support, he knows where he can go and where he can ask for advice. But someone like Angelo, you know, he's really quite vulnerable. He's got minimal speech. He basically communicates his needs to you, and that's it. You can't have a conversation with Angelo. He's obviously, you know, doesn't sleep very much and has no sense of danger. He just really needs an awful lot of support, and it can be quite tiring as a parent to be looking after someone like Angelo, because he's obviously physically quite tiring as well. So what I wanted to do was set up everything, because I worry about, you know, who's going to look after Angelo when I'm dead and gone. So now I'm thinking, I'm obviously not going to be able to look after him at home all the time. You know, he's coming up to be 19, he's a strapping lad, and I'm getting older, and I'm going to have to look at setting up a home for somebody like Angelo, or you know, maybe buy a house where I can arrange for carers to come in and take him to here, there and everywhere, so that he's constantly learning and, you know, developing all the time. Because, you know, Angelo, sometimes you think he doesn't take things on board, and then a few weeks later he'll do something, and then you'll think, oh, you were listening. Just because he's not visually, you know, or not saying it to me verbally, doesn't mean he's not taking on board what I'm saying. And he's also very in tune with the way I feel. So if I'm, like, feeling particularly down, or I might be feeling really shattered, you can see that he picks that up. And sometimes he'll just come up to me and just sort of stroke my face and give me a kiss on the cheek. Yeah. And, you know, because you can, it's autism is quite fascinating. I find it quite a fascinating subject, even though it's quite knackering.
Absolutely. I know. I can relate to all of that as well, you know, the circumstances we've got here too.
Yeah.
And you're right, it is our children that motivate us to carry on and do the things that we need to do.
I would never, ever thought in a million years that I could have achieved what I've achieved, to be honest with you, because I used to think people like doctors and psychologists and, you know, all these sort of professionals that were all quite above me, but they're just people like us, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
And a lot of them haven't got any common sense either, to be honest
with
you.
No.
Absolutely. Sorry, and all that professionals, but a lot of them just don't have common sense at all. And I just think if you've got the passion and you've got the enthusiasm and you can keep going, which is a big key thing, to keep going, you can achieve anything. You really can achieve anything.
Yeah, and that is very inspirational, absolutely. And talking about that, I mean, you've won many awards in the past few years as well, including the last year. Is it the Daily Mail Inspirational Woman of the Year?
And I was quite shocked, actually, because I've never in a million years I think I was going to win that, because I remember sitting around the table and all the finalists were around the table. And there was a lady there, her name was Katie, and I really thought she was the winner. I just thought she was so inspirational. This was the lady that ex-boyfriend of hers threw acid in her face. And
yes,
she
I've
set up,
seen the pictures.
Yeah, that's right. And I just thought she was the winner. And the chap from the Daily Mail, who was the editor, he had the gold envelope, and he was basically trying to get, they had this drum roll, and there was Natasha Kaplinsky was there, and they had a drum roll, and it was just like to try and unroll the envelope. Anyway, he couldn't get the envelope open, so they had to do another drum roll again, and he still couldn't get the envelope open. So I had my mobile phone and I was texting my sister, and I actually said, he can't even open the envelope. This is like, you know, I just thought of laughing, going lol, lol, lol type of thing, because I'm always texting my sister. And then they shouted, and once he did get it open, he ripped it open, and I wasn't even looking at him because I had my head down texting, and he just shouted, Anna Kennedy. And I just looked up and just thought, oh my God. And then I remember I had to do this long walk down to the stage, and I had high heels on. I thought, I'm just going to fall flat on my face, because my legs were feeling like jelly. And everyone was like patting me on the back. And then when I went on the stage, they said, what have you got to say? I went, bloody hell. And everyone burst out laughing. And Esther Ranson, who's patron of our school, she was jumping up and down. And it was just like a really incredible feeling, really. But to be honest with you, I use whatever opportunity I can to raise awareness about autism. It doesn't matter what it is. I'll just, because I think if one person's picked up something, it was worth doing. So that's what I constantly am thriving to do all the time.
Oh, excellent. Okay. In terms of politics as well, you're also a founder member of ACT Now campaign, the Autism Campaigners Together.
Yeah, Facebook is fantastic.
It is, isn't it? I know.
It can,
well,
I know it gets a lot. I know
Facebook,
it, it is. It, a lot of it, so sometimes it gets slated, doesn't it? You know, obviously, because not nice things happen on Facebook, but really positive things happened on Facebook. And I got into contact. Well, first of all, obviously, we became friends with a lady called Carol Rutherford, who is the ACT Now manager. And a lady called Alison Wiles, and then John Hopkinson has just come on board now. And there's a few other people that have started becoming part of the core group. But we ACT Now stands for Autism Campaigners Together. And basically, we're a group of people, and we're passionate, obviously, about the future and the well-being of our kids who've got an autism spectrum condition. And it's solely run by volunteers, and we're all volunteers that are doing this. And we liaise via Facebook, because we all live in different parts of the country. So you've got Carol that lives in Sunderland. I think John lives in Kent. I can't remember where Alison lives now. I think it was Essex. Yeah, Hertfordshire. Yeah. So we all live in different parts, and we've actually only met up twice. So that was once to hand the 6,000 signatures that we'd got from all parents that were concerned about the disability living allowance. So we basically we handed the signatures into number 10 Downing Street. So, and then obviously we had a meal after that. We were chatting. It was nice to meet and put a voice to a face, if you like. And now we're sort of in the third stage, and we're very worried about the works capability assessment and how it's going to be rolled out across the country, because we've heard about quite a few adults now that have basically said that they're fit to go to work when they're clearly not. And you've got all these ATOS assessments that will be going out soon, and that's obviously what we're very worried about, because they're this process really is going to be done by people who haven't got a clue about autism, really. So that's what we're worried about all those adults that are going to have the disability living allowance possibly taken away from them, or been forced into work when they really are not ready to go into work. So that's something that we're working on at the moment. And you can actually, if you're interested in becoming a member of ACT Now, you can find us on Facebook, and it's under ACT Now. We've got about 8,000, probably more than 8,000 supporters, I'd say, now.
Yeah.
And we've probably, I think we've got 13 regional groups at the moment, which is including people from Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And we've got about 25 regional coordinators, and our support's growing continuously all the time. So I think
Another
we're going to be a force
season.
To be reckoned with.
Absolutely. Yeah, fabulous. Fabulous. Okay, well, thank you ever so much, Anna, for this interview. It's been incredible. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
That's okay.
Before you go, though, is there anything else you'd like to say to anyone who's listening? Or,
well, if you're a parent, really, don't give in. What I say to parents is, put your body armour on, polish it, and off you go. Because if you don't speak for the rights of your children or adults, or if you're an adult, you know, try and get somebody to support you. But if not, you can always find someone on Facebook that'll help you with any of the processes, because not only are we parents, but I think a lot of us are professionals, because we've had to be, because we've had to learn the system, we've had to learn about autism and Asperger's syndrome, because there's nobody going to sit down and basically say, here you go.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is the answer for you.
Yeah,
so I think Facebook's great. If you want to join me on Facebook, that's fantastic. You'll have to go on Anna Kennedy Online because Facebook friends are full. Or if you want to send any articles to me on Anna Kennedy Online, I'm always looking for articles. So if anyone would like to write an article about their experiences, be very happy to put it on Anna Kennedy Online, because I've got about 18,000 people that follow me now, and it's growing all the time. So be very happy for any articles or any info that you come across.
Yeah. Okay, so your website, Anna?
My website is www.annakennedyonline.com. And if you're interested in reading my book, Not Stupid, you can get really cheap now on Amazon, something like £2 something a book. They're doing a special for the next few weeks, so if you're interested.
I've read it, it's brilliant. I can highly recommend that.
Absolutely. Oh, thank you. Okay.
And you're on Facebook, obviously, under Anna Kennedy Online.
I am, I'm on Anna Kennedy Online on Facebook, and I'm on Twitter. It's on Anna Kennedy number one, it is.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you ever so much for your time. I think everyone would really appreciate hearing your story.
Okay.
And I think what came through for me is, you know, it's about parents, isn't it? And the motivation for our children to just make life that better for them, and to have to put in the provision that they need for when they grow up and older, get older as well.
Okay.
So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you for taking the time to talk to me too.
That's okay. You take care.
All right. Thanking you.
Thanks, Anna. Bye-bye.
Bye.